This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Slayer Chronicles, First Kill, by Heather Brewer, performed by Alexander Sendes. Prologue. Abraham's heels clicked along the marble floor as he moved the length of the room. His breaths were even, as usual, but there was a tension in his muscles, an imminent dread that was impossible to ignore. The room was dim, the only light pouring in from the arched windows all along its longer side. It was growing dark. The sun was setting behind the building, casting a warm orange glow across the sky. Outside the window, the shadowed London eye stood watch. Seated in a tall, ornately carved chair at the end of the room was a man in his 80s, his hair frosty white. His eyes spoke with wisdom beyond anything that Abraham had yet to experience. To the old man's left and right were several smaller but just as ornate chairs, holding several other people, each of varying age and experience. Abraham knew each of them, some better than others, but no words or expressions of greeting were offered. This was not a social visit. He had been summoned for a distinct and important purpose. As Abraham approached, he knelt, following the usual pomp and circumstance of a Slayer Society headquarters meeting. With a nod, the old man gestured for him to stand and respond to his summons. Abraham stood, cleared his throat, and began.
"Masters, you have called me here with a question. The question of who will be next in my bloodline worthy of serving our noble cause. I submit to you that I have seen evidence of the Slayer gene in my nephew, Greg McMillan, and call upon you for permission to approach the boy with enlightenment."
A murmur passed through the gathered group, one filled with a doubt that troubled Abraham, though he would never admit to it. Once the murmurs had quieted, the elderly man spoke.
"You have been called upon to answer that question, yes, Abraham. But what of the child we have asked about? He seems far more likely to wield the stake some day than your nephew, Greg. As you know from tracing the bloodline, it has been determined that the next Slayer in your family will likely be a niece or nephew. But it is highly more likely that the child will be fostered by your brother Harold than your brother Michael. The genetic tests that we've run on hair and blood samples collected from both your brothers show that the Slayer gene is in its dormant state within Harold's genes, which means that his offspring are the likely receivers. The odds of this gene skipping generations and miraculously appearing within one of Michael's children is preposterous."
Abraham counted two heartbeats before he spoke again.
"Harold has a son and daughter, but neither Joss nor Cecile seems the right fit for the society's needs. Both are far too emotional and..."
"They are children, and children are emotional creatures, Abraham."
The old man waved his hand dismissively through the air.
"Tell us more about your nephew, Joss."
Abraham paused. He was never one to openly disagree with the society's whims, but for a brief moment he hesitated before answering.
"Joss is currently 10 years of age. Smart enough, with quick reflexes and adequate speed, but he lacks the drive to further his physical attributes, to better himself in that regard, of his own accord."
"He is not yet training age. 8 more years may awaken that drive within him."
Abraham's chest tightened.
"He is also incredibly empathetic."
"He has a scientific mind."
"He is not the next Slayer."
Despite his mastery of self-control, Abraham's voice rose, echoing off the walls of the Slayer Society headquarters. Once he realized it, he dropped his eyes in shame. The old man leaned forward, his demeanor calm, his expression full of compassion.
"We believe that he is, Abraham. The sooner you can come to accept that, the sooner you can begin preparations for his training."
Abraham shook his head, his eyes still on the marble floor below. When he spoke, his voice had softened to a near whisper, as if to make up for his previous tone.
"Joss is weak. Not just emotionally. Physically. I'm not sure he could survive the training."
The man sighed heavily and sat back in his chair.
"Then he will die, Abraham, and your bloodline in the society will end. But if he is the next slayer in your family, you will train him. Of that, you have no choice."
"And if he refuses to train?"
Even as the question left his tongue, Abraham reached out for it with all his wanting, but it was too late. He'd asked a query to which he already knew the answer. The old man met and held his gaze, a look of sadness about him as he replied,
"Kill him quickly. Family deserves mercy."
Chapter 1. The Next Great Adventure.
"Hey, brat."
"I'm not a brat. You're a brat."
Cecile wrinkled up her little nose, impossibly making herself even more adorable than she already was. Joss smiled. She was right. She wasn't a brat. But he loved teasing her, loved making her cross her arms defiantly in front of herself, the way she was doing now. Besides, it wasn't like she really thought he was being mean. He was just playing, as always. He reached out and gave one of her pigtails a light tug.
"You're a way bigger brat than me. Now come on. Mom says breakfast is ready. We're having French toast."
"Jossie, will you help me with this first?"
She held up the nude torso of a Barbie doll in one hand and the matted-haired, disembodied head of the doll in the other. Joss sighed. "Only if you stop calling me Jossie." It was a lie. He would have fixed it for her no matter what. He'd do anything for Cecile, but it was worth a try. Once he'd popped the poor doll's head back into place, he said, "Want a piggyback ride?"
"Yes."
She'd no sooner said the word than she had leaped onto Joss's back. They bounded down the stairs to the kitchen. As Joss ran, jiggling her up and down on purpose, Cecile squealed with laughter. The kitchen, decorated in clean, bright white and sunshine yellow, greeted the siblings with a warm, happy air. It had been home to them for 5 years, since 3 days before Cecile had celebrated her first birthday, and 8 days before Joss had celebrated his fifth. Joss loved this kitchen. He couldn't ever imagine gathering with his family anywhere else to discuss the coming events of the day or grabbing a snack with his sister in the afternoon once each had returned from school. The kitchen was more than just a room where they cooked their meals and ate their breakfast. It was the soul of their house. It was, more than any other room, home. Joss turned around and leaned back, dropping his little sister into her chair by the counter. As she landed with a thump, she erupted in laughter once again. Then Joss took his seat beside her. Their mom was busy dipping slices of bread into a bowl filled with cinnamon-speckled eggs, then delivering them into a sizzling hot pan on the stove. As she flipped each piece, she hummed a happy tune. No one, Joss thought, was as happy as his mom. She always wore a sunny expression and a smile on her face. She was warm and outgoing and more friendly and kind than anyone he had ever met. Cecile shifted impatiently in her seat. If there was anything more impossible for a young kid to wait for without at least a few complaints, it was French toast. Grabbing a pad of paper from the counter, Joss busied his sister with a quick game of tic-tac-toe. She won the first one, but set her bottom lip in a pout.
"You cheated, Jossie."
Joss shook his head.
"I didn't cheat. How could I cheat? You won. Nobody cheats to lose, Cecile."
Folding her arms in front of her, Cecile slanted her eyes at her big brother.
"You let me win. Don't let me win. I want to do it myself."
A smile settled on Joss's lips. She was smarter than he'd given her credit for. The truth was, he had let her win. He hadn't wanted her to feel the upset of losing, so he'd drawn an X next to where it would have been a winning move and silently congratulated himself on being such a good big brother. But Cecile was right. It would be better to have her learn on her own. After all, it wasn't winning that really counted, but the journey to that win. He nodded. Okay, let's play again. You X's or O's?
O's, I love O's.
Last game, you two. The French toast is almost done.
Mom went immediately back to humming her happy tune. The second game lasted merely seconds and ended with Cecile pouting.
I hate losing.
Joss tickled her ribs, instigating another fit of laughter. But did you have fun?
Ooh, yes,
Cecile shrieked. As Mom slid his plate in front of him, topped with a stack of French toast covered in sweet, sticky syrup, Joss smiled at his sister and picked up his fork, ready to dive in. Then that's all that matters. Once Joss had finished cleaning his plate and was scooping up every drop of gooey syrup that he could manage with his fork, he glanced at his mother, who was leaning against the counter, sipping her coffee and flipping through the morning paper.
Did Henry call yet? He's supposed to tell me what time they're coming tomorrow night.
She shook her head, looking up from the article she'd been immersed in.
Not yet, but I'm sure he'll call this afternoon. Are you sure you want to spend the whole summer with your cousins, Joss? That's a long time to be away from home. You might get homesick.
I'm sure. It's Henry. We're going to go camping and build a fort, and Greg's even going to teach us how to play baseball. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait to go.
As if in an afterthought, he muttered,
I wish school was already over.
From behind him, his dad ruffled his hair.
You only have one more day there, sport. I'm sure you'll survive.
Joss wasn't exactly convinced of that, but he smiled back at his dad before sliding off his stool and carrying his plate and fork to the sink, where he rinsed them clean before placing them in the dishwasher. As he retrieved his lunch sack from beside the microwave on the counter, his mom caught him in a hug, her worried mom eyes meeting his gaze. She smelled like tangerines and French toast.
You behave for Aunt Matilda and Uncle Mike. And you call if you need anything, even if you just feel homesick, okay?
Joss gave her a squeeze, resisting the urge to roll his eyes at how she was acting. He could take care of himself, and he was always nice to his aunt and uncle. But his mom was taking a weekend trip to see his ill grandmother this afternoon, so she'd be gone before Joss got home from school today, and couldn't wait until then to say whatever she felt she needed to say. And she wouldn't get back until Sunday afternoon. Tomorrow evening, Joss would be barreling down the road in his uncle's car, playing the alphabet game with his favorite cousin. But right now, it was his job to make sure that his mom felt okay about letting him leave for almost 3 months. He gave her another squeeze.
I'll call you, Mom. I promise. Lots.
Slipping from her arms, he picked up his backpack and flung it over his shoulder, planted a peck on Cecile's head, and waved to his dad on his way out the door. The bus was already waiting for him at the stop, so Joss ran. As he climbed aboard bus 13, a familiar tension settled into his stomach. Most of the seats were completely occupied, and the ones that weren't were occupied by one person. As he made his way down the aisle, jostling slightly at the rough movement of the bus as it took off down his street, several lone seat occupants slid their legs into the empty space beside them. One set his backpack in the space, indicating that it too was taken. The message was clear. You're not welcome.
Sit down back there.
The bus driver's voice was rough and raw as if he'd been screaming at kids all morning. The last thing Joss wanted was to be the subject of more screams, so he turned to a pale, freckled boy who was currently sitting in the middle of a green bench seat and said,
Hey man, let me sit here, okay?
The kid glanced around as if seeking the approval of his peers. Then he sighed heavily and slid in toward the window. Joss thanked him and took his seat. The remainder of the bus ride was quiet and awkward. In other words, it was a typical day so far for Joss McMillan. When the bus came to a stop in front of Summers Elementary, the boy he'd sat by pushed past him as if eager to be free of Joss. Joss hung back. He was in no hurry to begin his school day and had no one waiting for him to step off the bus. Joss was, for the most part, alone. And what's more, he'd convinced himself over the last 2 years that he actually preferred being alone. It was a lie that he told himself every day to cover up the pain of being completely friendless. If only his cousin Henry went to the same school he did. Henry was funny, inventive, and never once questioned the things that Joss did. If Joss ran faster than him, Henry gave chase. If Joss caught a ball, Henry slapped him on the back in approval. Henry was the best friend a guy could have, but he didn't go to Joss's school. By the time the bus had all but emptied, Joss had summoned up the courage to exit the bus and enter the school. No one really looked at him as he moved up the sidewalk or down the hall. In fact, if Joss hadn't been able to feel the warmth of the sun on his shoulders or the cool of the air-conditioned hallway, he might have thought that he was dreaming. Or a ghost. Either, he mused, would have been better than being the invisible boy. He wasn't certain when he'd become invisible, only knew that it had something to do with his ability to outrun everyone in the school, even the kids who were all about sports. Joss could catch a ball like nobody's business, was an excellent thrower, and an amazingly fast runner. His reflexes and strength surpassed even the most gifted athlete his age at Summers Elementary, and for some reason, that made him a target for hatred. He'd tried making friends, but no one, not even the unpopular kids who got wedgies every day, wanted anything to do with Joss. So he floated through school, the invisible boy, getting good grades and waiting for someone to notice him. He doubted that would ever happen. The last day of school before summer break began was pretty much useless as far as anything regarding education went. Before Joss realized it, the recess bell rang. He liked recess. Not for the usual reasons, but because recess meant that he could seek out his favorite spot in the hollow of the old oak tree on the far corner of the playground and immerse himself in whatever nonfiction tome he'd discovered recently among the piles of books in his local library, his latest favorite being the study of assassin bugs. He'd begun gathering as many of the creatures as he could find and placing them in his collection for display. Assassin bugs, it turned out, would lie in wait for other insects and then stab the prey with their beak and inject a toxin that would dissolve the prey's tissue. Then they'd suck up the other bug's insides like a Slurpee. And sometimes, when other food wasn't available, assassin bugs would even eat each other. The idea fascinated Joss. The playground at Summers Elementary was small, but filled with everything that a kid could ask for. 3 swing sets, a jungle gym, teeter-totters, monkey bars, a merry-go-round, and a giant slide occupied the grass-free area behind the school. Mostly, Joss would escape to his hiding place behind the tree, but every once in a while, like this day, he braved the far set of swings, the ones that were just small enough to make them appear boring to the rest of the kids. He sat on the swing on the end of the set, the one closest to his tree, and swung back and forth quietly, daydreaming about all the fun he and Henry were going to have this summer. Several yards in front of him, a group of kids was playing kickball. Joss watched with an air of disinterest, despite the fact that he very much wanted to play with them. But he knew, from times past, that his efforts to interact would be met with denial. Still, when a boy he recognized from the lunchroom misjudged his kick, sending the ball flying in Joss's direction, Joss's instincts took over and he leaped from the swing, catching the ball in his hands before his feet had even touched the ground. The boy who kicked the ball dropped his arms to his side, a look of annoyance on his face. Several heads turned Joss's way to see what was causing the upset, and each of their expressions darkened as well. Joss's jaw began to feel very tight. Holly Whitaker stepped forward, hands on her hips.
"Give us the ball back, Joss."
She acted as if it hadn't been kicked toward him, as if he'd invaded their game and had stolen away the ball on purpose. His jaw ached from the tension.
"I didn't mean to catch it. It just kind of happened."
Tommy Hart snorted.
"Yeah, just like it kind of happened that you beat Billy at that race last week, cheater."
Joss turned the ball nervously over in his hands. The truth was, he hadn't cheated, but he had forgotten to pull his speed back so that Billy could win and save Joss the embarrassment of being unusually quick.
"I didn't cheat. I'm just fast."
Holly stepped closer, her voice filled with venom.
"Everybody knows you're a cheater, Joss. Now give the ball back, cheater."
With a clenched jaw, Joss held the red ball up for all to see.
"This ball?"
Then, before she could reach for it, Joss dropped the ball, raising his foot in a kick. The ball went flying, so high that it seemed to be enveloped by the sun. Then it came down, settling atop the roof of the school. A feeling filled him quickly, then shrank away again as if hiding in shame. It was joy for having taken revenge. Joss's stomach twisted and turned with guilt. He wasn't proud of his actions. In fact, he was sickened by them. But what was done was done. He blinked at Holly and the others, whose faces wore looks of surprise, anger, and hurt. "I'm sorry." They didn't believe him. Who would? But Joss was sorry. He'd let his anger and desire for revenge get in the way. Before anyone could give him a richly deserved punch in the eye, the bell rang, signifying the end of recess. Joss tried to apologize again, but each member of the kickball group simply shook their heads, as if they hadn't expected any better from the likes of him, and gravitated toward the school. Once the playground was empty, Joss followed, hanging his head in shame. The rest of the day passed blissfully without incident. Once at home again that afternoon, Joss lugged his backpack through the front door and flung it into the hall closet. He hurried into the kitchen and had to resist the urge to jump up and down when he saw the answering machine flashing that there was one message waiting. He pushed the button and held his breath hopefully.
"Hey, Joss! Henry here! Dad said to tell you we'd be there at 5 o'clock tomorrow, so get packed and ready. Oh, and Mom said not to bring any bugs. They gross her out. See ya!"
With happiness moving his feet, Joss ran up the stairs to his bedroom. His suitcase had already been packed by his mother the night before, but Joss wanted to double-check that she hadn't forgotten things like his magnifying glass or his well-worn paperback copy of Identifying Insects. Neither were sitting on his desk where he left them, but Joss made a mental note to check his suitcase as soon as he went downstairs. Parents, even well-meaning parents, just couldn't be trusted with the important things. Looking over his room, Joss sighed. The truth was, he was really going to miss waking up here every morning for the next few months. He loved his room, loved the jars on his bookshelves filled with various stick bugs, loved the framed specimens on his walls. His favorite was, of course, the black corsair hanging over his bed, a gift from his grandfather when he was 8. He remembered that trip vividly. He and his parents had gone to visit his grandparents on the outskirts of Bowling Green, Kentucky one summer. His grandfather was teaching him how to chop wood for their campfire one night, and as they turned over a log, Joss spied the most magnificent specimen of insect that he'd ever seen. It was in perfect condition, shiny black head and dull black wings. Grandpa told Joss that a black corsair was a nasty little critter, and that Melanolestes piscipes, as they were known in the scientific world, would run down other insects in their hunt for food. It would chase them and never stop until it caught its prey. They were known to suck the blood of rodents and even humans, and, disturbingly enough, they preferred to go for the eyes and lips. Luckily, this one was dead already. His grandfather took it home and mounted it, and 6 months later, Joss had opened it as a gift under the Christmas tree. He treasured it. Not just because it was such a rare species, but because it had been a gift from his grandfather, who'd inspired his love of entomology before passing from this life into the next great adventure. That's what he'd called dying, the next great adventure. Grandpa believed that beyond this life there was something bigger, something better for us all. The thought gave Joss a smile. He missed his grandfather. That night, after dinner and some mindless television, Joss lay tucked neatly in his bed, staring up at the frame of the black corsair and wondering if his grandfather had been right about death, if it really was an adventure and not something to fear. With that thought, he drifted off into a deep, dreamless slumber. Chapter 2. Cecile. Nothing had woken Joss. He was awake, certainly. He lay in his bed, cozy and warm, despite the chill of the night, but there had been no sound, no movement that brought him out of sleep. There was only the darkness, and a feeling that something wasn't quite right. As he pulled the covers back, that little voice in his head, the one that'd been enjoying his soft bed and cozy covers, told him to cover up quickly and forget about the unsettling feeling that was poking at the edges of his brain. It was nothing, the voice urged, probably just the wind. But Joss couldn't go back to sleep, no matter how tired he was. He had to take a look around and see for certain that nothing had woken him, and that all was well and nothing was lurking under his bed or just inside his closet door. He paused before swinging his feet over the edge of his bed. He didn't believe in monsters. His dad had explained movie special effects to him at a very young age, and his mom had told him all about the genius of the imagination. But a part of him, a small part, shrank back in fear at the idea of placing his feet on the floor in the dark, not knowing who or what might be lurking underneath his bed at this late hour. What if it had scales or claws or a venom that it might inject into Joss and proceed to slurp out his insides? Nonsense. Monsters weren't real. With a determined breath, Joss's feet hit the floor, and the sudden shock of cold sent them back underneath the covers for a moment. Maybe the voice in his head was right. Maybe it was nothing. But then there was a noise, soft and familiar. For some reason, it sent a bolt of fear through him as it never had before. Cecile was crying. Despite his initial resistance to her very existence, Joss adored his baby sister, and he was the only person in their house who was even remotely capable of calming her down after a nightmare, which meant that despite the nip in the air, he was getting out of bed. Tiptoeing across the bare wood floor, Joss crept to his bedroom door and put his ear to the wood. Cecile had quieted, but he was sure she'd start up again soon. Her nightmares were never brief. Without reason, she'd been having them since she was a toddler. They'd come on the heels of her night terrors and could only be calmed by the presence of Joss and his assurance that everything would be all right. He wrapped his fingers around the doorknob and turned, pulling the door until it opened a few inches. Cecile was silent. Joss furrowed his brow and looked longingly back at his warm bed. But a noise drew his attention to the hallway, the soft creak of mattress springs. Curiosity filled Joss, and he crept down the hall towards Cecile's mostly closed bedroom door. Stopping in front of it, Joss whispered,
"Cecile!"
There was no sound. Not from Cecile or anything else. The air was heavy with silence. It was almost too quiet. Joss leaned forward, pressing his forehead against the wood until the door opened just a crack and he could peer inside. What he saw stopped his heart from beating for several moments. Joss scrambled back from the door. He backed hard into the wall behind him, his jaw hanging open in utter horror, his trembling fingers clamping tight over his mouth so that his screams would not escape. He slid to the floor, frozen in absolute fear. Cecile, small, sweet, 6-year-old Cecile, was lying on her bed, pale as snow. A dark, fluid line had been drawn from her neck to her pink ballerina sheets. Blood. Cecile's blood. Her eyes, thankfully, were closed. She wasn't moving. Standing by her bed was a man that wasn't a man. His teeth were razor sharp and pointed. His skin was paler than Cecile's. He was a monster, and looked like every stereotypical vampire that Joss had ever seen in a movie or on television. Joss couldn't move. Not to check on his sister, not to force the terrible creature from their home, not to call for his mom or dad, he couldn't budge. And what's worse, the creature, the monster, had noticed him. It licked Cecile's blood from its lips and stepped into the hall, crouching before Joss. And when it sighed, Joss almost gagged at the smell of his sister's blood on its tongue.
"Little one," it said as if they were old acquaintances, "you weren't supposed to see this, or me. So forget my face. It will be easier for both of us."
Then the monster touched his finger lightly to Joss's temple, and Joss screamed. Chapter 3. The Death of a Family. The funeral home was packed with people, most of whom Joss either didn't know or simply had no memory of meeting before. All around the room were banquets of pink roses. At the far end of the room, at the farthest point from where Joss was seated with his hands folded and head down, was a small white coffin. Inside was Cecile, or what had once been Cecile. He had silently begged the powers that be that her coffin would be closed, that her body wouldn't be put on display for people to gawk at. But his pleas had fallen on deaf ears, it seemed. So Joss stayed where he was, at the back of the funeral home and refused every suggestion that he go up and say his goodbyes. He would never say goodbye to his sister. Never. He wouldn't cry over her shell until his pain had been relieved either. No, he would use that pain, tuck it somewhere inside of him until he had the strength to find whatever had killed her and bring it to justice somehow. He'd told his parents about the monster, that he'd seen a creature looming over his bleeding sister, but could not seem to recall its face, no matter how hard he tried. Whenever the smallest detail of the face would begin to creep into his mind, it was whisked away by a gray fog. But they wouldn't listen. They thought a madman had killed Cecile. Joss had tried explaining to the police what happened that night, but no one would listen to him. They simply exchanged glances that indicated that he was merely a hysterical little boy who'd witnessed the brutal murder of his sister. Of course he saw monsters. What other way could his young mind possibly deal with seeing what he actually had? Now his parents were standing across the room, near Cecile's coffin, as distant from him physically as they had been emotionally since Cecile had died. It had started the moment the police had left that night. All of a sudden, Joss had become the invisible boy at home, the way he was at school. He hadn't just lost his sister that night. He lost his family, too. His parents had said nothing to him on the drive to the funeral home, and once they'd entered the building, it was as if they had had only one child, and that child was Cecile. Joss squeezed the photograph in his hand, careful not to wrinkle it. He'd taken it from the refrigerator door this morning, knowing that he wanted to look at Cecile, but also knowing that he couldn't possibly stare at her corpse and convince himself that that was his sister. The object lying in that coffin wasn't Cecile. It was merely bones and tissue held together by preservatives. His sister was now experiencing the next great adventure. He hoped death was that anyway, that something lay beyond this life. Otherwise, his sister was a part of nothingness now. The thought brought tears to his eyes.
"There's no shame in shedding tears for Cecile, Joss."
Joss looked up. He hadn't noticed his Uncle Abraham enter the room or sit down beside him. But there he was, dressed in a black three-piece suit, his expression appropriately solemn. Abraham reached into his inside jacket pocket and withdrew a cloth handkerchief, holding it out for his nephew. Joss shook his head and willed his tears away, careful to keep his attention focused on Abraham and away from Cecile's coffin. With a nod, Abraham tucked the handkerchief away again.
"I've been told you were there when it happened."
Joss nodded. He didn't know his uncle very well, had only encountered him on occasional holidays, at parties held by other distant relatives. He didn't know much about him, really. Only that his uncle was a professor of some sort, and a world traveler.
"I was, but no one believes what I saw."
Abraham raised an eyebrow.
"And what is it that you saw, exactly?"
Joss swallowed hard, clutching Cecile's picture to his chest, the threat of tears overwhelming him. But he wouldn't cry. He wouldn't allow himself that moment of weakness, not until his sister had been avenged.
"I don't remember its face, but I do remember the blood, Cecile's blood."
"An injury?"
"Something like that. I can't remember. My brain is too foggy."
"Where was your sister bleeding from, and how much blood was there?"
Joss's heart grew heavy. He looked at his uncle and begged him with a glance to cease this line of questioning immediately. Abraham gave his shoulder a squeeze, his eyes full of pity.
"A morbid question, nephew, but I must know."
The memory of that night filled his mind. Cecile in her bed, that liquid line of blood running down her neck to her pink ballerina sheets. Joss's hands gripped the chair he was sitting in without him even being aware of it.
Her neck. She was bleeding from her neck. There wasn't a lot of blood, not as much as you'd think.
Joss had once read that an average human child had 2.3 liters of blood pumping around inside of them, so he was amazed by what little blood had actually been spilled in his sister's murder. He never would have confessed those thoughts to his parents, though. They might have locked him up in a nut house if he admitted to thinking such things. Abraham leaned a bit closer and spoke in a conspiratorial whisper.
Take a deep breath, Joss. Clear your thoughts, and don't force the memory. The harder you think about it, the more like sand the memory will become, slipping between your fingers until there's nothing left to grasp. Now, tell me, what was the weapon that cut Cecile?
Inside the memory of that night, Joss looked up at the man's face, but it was just a gray fog. As his uncle had suggested, he took a deep breath and relaxed. Slowly, the fog began to lift, revealing the man's mouth and horrible, blood-drenched fangs. Joss gasped and locked his eyes with his uncle's.
Fangs! It had fangs! That man!
He didn't know how he could have forgotten such a critical detail of the event, but now he knew why he'd considered Cecile's murderer a monster. Not just because the man had killed a child, but because the man wasn't really a man at all. He was a monster, a creature, a thing. Joss's heart raced in terror. What if it came back? What if it wanted to finish Joss off, too? Abraham sat there in quiet contemplation for a moment before giving Joss's back a gentle pat. After another moment of silence, he stood and moved down the aisle to the coffin. He'd come here to pay his respects, and had somehow gotten wrapped up in his nephew's newly bloomed madness. Clearly, he wanted to get out of here as soon as possible. Joss didn't blame him. But to Joss's surprise, moments later, his uncle had returned to his seat beside Joss. Abraham nodded.
It seems you are correct, Joss. Something, not someone, did take young Cecile's life. I suspect the guilty party is a vampire.
Joss looked at his uncle, trying to gauge whether or not Abraham was playing some sick joke on him at his sister's funeral. All he saw was complete honesty and understanding, but his mind couldn't shut out the questions it begged.
How can vampires possibly be real? And how could we not know about them all this time?
Abraham's eyes were on the mourners as they passed by Cecile's coffin.
Joss should have been up there too, but he just couldn't bear it. Maybe Abraham understood that, or maybe he was just waiting until they finished their conversation to see if Joss would go.
Do you know how big snakes get? Or how many grains of sand are in the deserts? Or exactly what lurks on the bottoms of the ocean's floors?
Joss thought about each query. He dug deep into the recesses of his mind, but came up empty.
No?
Well, if you can't answer those simple scientific queries, then what makes you think that mankind is smart enough to discover vampire kind's existence?
Abraham raised an eyebrow at his nephew then. He'd made a valid point. Who was to say that humans knew all there was to know about our planet? Joss thought about the so-called scientific evidence behind vampirism that he had read about in the books at the library. So much paranoia, so many graves dug up, all because corpses would bloat, making their bellies look full, while gums shrank, making their incisors appear as fangs? Joss hardly thought so. It sounded like a lame attempt at an explanation to him. So maybe his uncle was right. Maybe vampires really existed. Maybe one had killed his sister.
I have connections to that world, if you want justice, Joss.
Abraham's chin was strong, his jaw set, as if he very much wanted justice for Cecile as well.
All you need to do is swear on it. Swear on your dedication to taking those monsters down, and I will give you every tool you require to do so.
Joss looked down at the picture in his hand before allowing his eyes to trace along the room to the white coffin at the other end for the first time. He swallowed hard and said, I swear. Abraham leaned closer, his voice just above a whisper.
We are called the Slayer Society. And you now belong to us. We'll train you. We'll protect you. We'll be closer to you than any family could. I can't begin training you yet. The rules dictate that you must first be 18 years old before that can happen. But in the meantime, you should start honing your natural skills.
But I don't have any natural skills. Josh shook his head adamantly. He was just a boy. Just an ordinary person.
Of course you do. You have incredible agility and speed. Amazing reflexes.
Abraham spoke without question, and Joss couldn't help but wonder how he could know these things about his nephew, the nephew he'd only rarely seen or spent time with.
Use the next few years to practice running, archery, wrestling, anything that you can to become the best. Then, after you turn 18, I'll send for you. When you see a red wax seal on a letter, hide away and read it alone. It's a secret, as is everything to do with the society.
Joss nodded, taking this all in.
Can I tell Henry?
No. You can tell no one. Nor can you discuss anything pertaining to the society with anyone but those within the society.
Abraham stood and reached into one of his outer pockets. What he withdrew, he placed into Joss's hand.
This was your grandfather's. He would have wanted you to have it. He was a slayer as well.
Joss squeezed the pocket watch in his hand. Grandpa had been a slayer too? No wonder he'd looked on death as an adventure. Death, after all, was just a continuation of life to Grandpa, and it seemed his life had been a series of secret adventures. Death was just the next one. Grandpa was a slayer. And now Joss was, too. As Abraham moved through the crowd saying his goodbyes, Joss looked down at his grandfather's pocket watch. Setting the watch in his lap, he tore the photograph of Cecile until it made a circle around her face, then placed it inside his grandfather's watch. It was a reminder to himself never to forget, and to always, always remember those that you care about. He slid the pocket watch inside his front pants pocket and sat back in his chair, musing over exactly what the Slayer Society was and exactly how they were going to help him take down the monster that had killed Cecile.
Hey!
Joss looked up to find his cousin Henry wearing a suit that was too big on him and looking like he felt very, very awkward. Normally, Henry was a really funny guy, but even he, it seemed, knew when an occasion called for a more somber approach.
Hey, Henry. I'm sorry you're not coming to spend the summer with me after all.
Henry's eyes went wide, as if he'd just said the dumbest thing ever.
And about Cecile. She was a nice kid.
Joss nodded, trying hard to keep his thoughts away from his sister and the body lying in the coffin at the other end of the room.
Maybe next summer. Yeah, maybe.
Henry hung his head. He didn't speak anymore. Just stood there awkwardly, likely wishing that he had some words of comfort to offer his cousin. But Joss knew that there was nothing Henry or anyone else could say. This pain ran deep, and only by erasing the cause of this pain would it ever go away. The man with fangs had caused this pain, and he would pay dearly for it. A preacher stood and said words that Joss couldn't bear to listen to. After he was finished, everyone began filing out. Henry, who was sitting beside Joss, looked perplexed.
Where's everybody going?
To the dinner. Joss furrowed his perplexed brow for a moment.
Isn't it weird how people feel the need to eat after funerals?
Henry nodded. Then his mood brightened some.
Do you think they'll have cake?
Chapter 4. Introductions. Joss slipped his pen inside one of the small pockets of his backpack and turned his attention back to the leather-bound journal on his lap. It had taken 3 years, 3 long, tormented years for him to put pen to page and fully describe what had happened the night he'd lost Cecile.
It was as if the pain of her death had somehow sealed the descriptive abilities within him, and receiving his Uncle Abraham's letter last week had finally set his pen free. He hadn't told his parents about the Slayer Society. His uncle had strictly forbidden it. They wouldn't have believed him anyway. Who could blame them? If he'd rambled on about some secret club that would help him hunt down the horrible vampire who drank his sister's blood and touched his temple, erasing the memory of its face from Joss's young mind, they would have put him away in some asylum somewhere. In the nut house, as his father was fond of saying. Joss's Aunt Margaret was put in the nut house 10 years ago. From what his father had said, having to put her there had almost made Abraham crazy enough to go to the nut house too. But then something made Abraham's sanity snap firmly back into place. Time had passed, Cecile had died, and last week Abraham had sent Joss a train ticket. All that had accompanied it was a letter explaining to Joss's parents that he wanted Joss to spend the summer with him teaching him survival skills out at a cabin in the woods. The letter was a lie.
"I swear,"
Joss whispered in remembrance of the day he had vowed to hunt down his sister's killer and those like him. He closed the journal and slid it inside the largest pocket of his backpack. He was ready for whatever his uncle had in store for him, even though he had no idea at all what that might be. He had trained for 3 years, running as far and as fast as he could manage, perfecting his archery, building up his senses in the wilds of the woods near his house, all things that Abraham had written to him about and instructed him to do. And in the 3 years since Cecile's death, Joss had come to understand that he wasn't just looking to erase the vampire who'd killed Cecile simply to ease his pain. He wanted the beast to suffer for what he did. Joss wanted justice. The train jostled and bumped along the tracks. He'd been on trains for 4 days, traveling the long road from Santa Carla, California to Rhinecliff, New York. A plane would have been faster and probably cheaper, but still, his uncle had sent only the train ticket and the simple note. He trusted that there was a reason for this choice. After all, his uncle seemed a reasonable man, so who was he to argue? Joss had smiled a false smile at his parents, who'd waved the invisible boy away, still locked tightly in their grief, and packed clothing for a summer vacation that would never happen. This summer, after all, wasn't about camping or hiking or learning about the ways of nature. It was about a new beginning. It was about vengeance. Even though his uncle hadn't precisely said those words, Joss knew he'd meant them. It was time for Joss to begin his search for the monster that had killed Cecile. He had wondered why Abraham had sent for him now and hadn't waited until Joss turned 18, but he was sure his uncle had his reasons and would explain them once he reached the cabin. His knee bounced in anticipation of the train stop. He was anxious, anxious to begin his official training and start his life anew.
"Rhinecliff! Next stop, Rhinecliff!"
The conductor's voice boomed through the car, jolting Joss from his thoughts. There was something old-world about it, and Joss couldn't shake the feeling that he was going back in time, to a place where people traveled by trains and were shouted at by conductors. The part of him that had watched every episode of The Twilight Zone wondered briefly if, when he stepped off the train, it would be into his time or another, his world or another. The thought worried him, unsettling his stomach a bit, so he pushed it down deep and gathered up his belongings, waiting for the train to slow. Once the train jerked to a stop, Joss descended the narrow stairs, luggage in hand, and stepped for the first time onto the platform of the Amtrak station in Rhinecliff, New York. His eyes swept across the platform, but he didn't see his uncle anywhere. After a moment, he followed the ebbing crowd, which consisted of merely 6 people, up the long staircase and through the hangar-like room into the train station itself. Once again, he looked around, and once again, he didn't see his uncle. Suddenly nervous, Joss wheeled his suitcase over to one of the wooden benches and took a seat. There was little he could do now but wait, and hope like hell that his uncle hadn't forgotten about him. Rapid footfalls drew his attention to the door that led to the section of building that resembled a hangar. Someone was running, their shoes slapping against the floor in a hurried pace, one that suggested they meant business. Behind them was another set of footfalls, Joss watched the open door, waiting to see the runner. A girl burst through the door, her eyes wide and frightened. Joss hadn't noticed her on the platform before, but she was here now, running from where the train had been, looking scared out of her mind. Behind her was a man, dressed in black and gaining ground. The girl whipped past Joss and out the front door of the station. Just as the man passed him, Joss reacted instinctively and put his foot out. He didn't know what made him do it, only knew that the man was chasing that girl, and she'd look so scared. He had to stop it, whatever it was, from happening. The man stumbled over Joss's ankle and went down hard, but before he hit the floor, he caught himself somehow, without touching anything at all that Joss could see, and stood back up. Slowly, he turned his head to face Joss, his eyes piercing and dark. His face was very pale. He searched Joss's face for a moment, as if something about him seemed familiar. Joss straightened his shoulders and opened his mouth to speak, even though he was half convinced that all that would come out would be a squeak. He was surprised how confident his voice sounded, and how steady his words were, despite the fact that he was shaking. "Leave her alone," the man smiled then, again slowly, and it occurred to Joss that the man before him had to focus to do anything slowly at all, because he was used to being unnaturally quick. This thought both surfaced and descended back into the recesses of Joss's mind very quickly, almost unnoticeably. Then the man's smile grew into a maddening grin, revealing two sharp fangs within his mouth. Joss jumped backward at the sight, his heart racing. Broken images of the monster who'd killed Cecile filled his thoughts, images of fangs and blood, but no face. The man, the thing, the vampire in front of him laughed.
"I don't know who Cecile is, but I'm afraid I haven't had the pleasure. Now, why don't you have a seat and mind your own business, Slayer? This girl is of no consequence to you."
Slayer. The monster had called him a Slayer. What did that mean? How did this thing know about the Slayer Society and Cecile? Joss shook his head, shaking all images of Cecile's face from the forefront of his mind. He thought of the girl who'd run outside, how frightened she'd seemed. He could only imagine how scared Cecile had been the night she'd died. Joss tightened his jaw.
"Like hell she isn't!"
The creature glared at him for a moment. Joss was certain it was going to lunge forward and rip his throat out. Joss briefly glanced around the station, but it seemed no one else had noticed the fangs.
"Do we have a problem, gentlemen?"
Joss flicked his eyes over to the man who'd interrupted their attention. Young, mid-30s, slate-gray eyes and dirty blonde hair sheared into a short military cut. He was lean, but Joss could tell by the way the fabric of his shirt lay on his frame that he was also muscular. And he was hoping that muscular meant strong, because he was going to need every ounce of help he could get if this thing came to blows. The man raised an eyebrow at the vampire, setting his jaw as if he were very much aware of what kind of monster he was dealing with.
"Is there something the boy or I can help you with?"
The vampire emitted a low, guttural growl. It came off as a territorial warning, but Joss wasn't entirely sure why.
"Cyrus?"
The corner of the man's mouth twitched slightly. His hand slowly moved to the leather satchel on his hip. He dropped his tone so that no one else in the station would hear.
"The boy is one of ours, and if you're informed enough to know my name, you must know the girl is mine. I'm willing to turn the other cheek this time, but if you make a move, I'm authorized and fully capable of taking you down, despite the complication of exposure. So think about your next move before you make it. Think long and hard, and then do it. But do it knowing that I'll take great pleasure in killing you."
The vampire seemed to weigh Cyrus's seriousness for a moment. Then, judging him to be an honest man, it nodded and moved out the door. Cyrus shook his head and turned back to Joss.
"Good to have you aboard, Slayer. I wouldn't have wanted to face him myself, truth be told. Not in a public place. It could have gotten messy. And judging by his calculated movements, he's accustomed to moving among vampires more than humans, which means he'd be strong. Maybe too strong for the likes of me,
but the two of us, we probably could have taken him. Joss blinked in mild confusion.
Taken him? You mean taken him down? But he's a vampire.
The word fell off his tongue and tumbled to the floor in a whisper. It felt strange. It felt surreal. Cyrus nodded.
And we are slayers.
I'm not a slayer. I'm not even sure I know what that is, but I assume it means someone who kills vampires, and I'm not that.
But even as he uttered the words, he knew them not to be true. After all, wasn't that why he'd come here? To avenge his sister's death? Surely that would involve a little killing on his part. Joss swallowed, but his throat was parched. Cyrus seemed to size him up for a bit before speaking again.
But you are a slayer, Joss. You swore an oath 3 years ago, and every day since then has been preparing you for this day.
At the back of his mind, Joss heard his 10-year-old self responding to his uncle with a determined voice.
I swear.
Cyrus kept his voice even, as if he possessed an immeasurable amount of patience.
Yes, you did.
And the next day your father was hired by a new company, a company that unbeknownst to your family is owned and run by the Slayer Society, a company that moved you to how many different places in just 3 years, Joss?
Too many.
And each of those cities was chosen for a reason. Some of the most talented Slayers in the Society are stationed in those places. You are being moved around so that each of those Slayers, highly respected members of the Society, could size you up and confirm that you are as we are, a Slayer. He reached a hand forward as if to give Joss's shoulder a comforting squeeze, then thought better of it and dropped his hand to his side. After they'd analyzed you, it was time for you to come here, to be trained in the art of slaying and eventually indoctrinated into the Society. And to be honest, I was hoping that Abraham would be the one to explain it all to you. Joss shook his head, not in utter disbelief, but in shock that he had somehow missed the exquisite detail of the Society's plans. At the time, it had seemed like just a bit of luck when his father scored a well-paying position at a seemingly reputable company. It had been a bit strange that the company was willing, no, eager, Joss recalled his dad saying, to move his family along with him. And Joss had faced each move with grave determination, knowing that it would be just another house and never a home. Straining now, he couldn't seem to recall anyone who'd obviously been a slayer. But then, he supposed, they had just been incredibly good at their job and blended in. He wished, much like Cyrus, that his uncle had told him that he was being reviewed by the Slayer Society. He took a breath and let it out slowly before meeting Cyrus's eyes.
When do I see my uncle?
The great Abraham McMillan? Most highly regarded slayer of our time?
Cyrus smiled and then nodded slowly as if making a decision about Joss, a decision he would not put voice to.
Depends on traffic. The cabin is about an hour's drive from here, when nobody's on the road. The girl you saw is my daughter. She knows nothing of the Society, and I plan to keep it that way. Secrecy is our biggest ally. So watch what you say while she's around, okay?
Don't worry. I'll be careful with what I say.
He reached for his suitcase, but Cyrus grabbed it first and led him out the station door. With every step, Joss felt more excited the farther away he got from the life that he had known. He was leaving it all behind, all for the love of his sister and his determination to locate the monster that had killed her and right a wrong that never should have been. Joss stepped out into the bright summer sun and squinted until a large, puffy cloud did him a favor and crossed over the sun, blessing him with brief shade. In front of him, Cyrus had approached a beat-up pickup truck that had been red in its glory days, but was now closer to brown. After placing Joss's suitcase in the back, he pulled a